Chapter 9. Whoever he was good. Steele didn't pick him up until he was several blocks away from his building. He might have not have picked him up at all if his amplified hearing had not alerted him to the sound of the man's footsteps following him. It was late, and the streets were deserted. Even in Midtown, people knew better than to chance going out at this hour of the night, unless it was absolutely necessary. The occasional cab passed by as he walked purposefully towards Lower Manhattan. And once a police cruiser drove by slowly, stopping to investigate the man walking down the street carrying a 4.3mm caseless battle rifle. But when they saw his strike force fatigues and recognized him, they relaxed, conferred with him briefly, and drove on. There had been no further sightings of Stalker, and Steele carried a portable radio, tuned to the police band, just in case. The choppers were out patrolling overhead. At least for now, everything was relatively quiet. He had purposefully chosen to come out and head down into no man's land on street level, rather than take a chopper or a car. He wanted to make himself a target, if not for Stalker, then for anyone else, any hapless mugger whose path he might happen to cross. The fury and frustration that he felt needed an outlet. He wanted to strike out at somebody. Anybody. He had gone about 8 blocks when he became aware that he was being followed. On this quiet night, with nothing but the distant sounds of chopper blades or sirens to break up this tense stillness of the city, he was easily able to pick out the sounds of footsteps coming from about a block or so behind him. Whoever it was, he was being careful. It could be a mugger, Steele thought. But it would also have to be a pretty desperate mugger, or a crazy one, to risk going up against a man carrying an assault rifle in plain view. But it was possible. There were some stone-cold crazies who came out of their holes at night. Some of them would easily risk it for the chance of gaining the rifle. And though Steele was wearing black Strike Force fatigues, he was not wearing the battle helmet or the backpack with its built-in computer and rocket launchers. So whoever was stalking him might not realize that he was a cop. Either that, or his pursuer was so hardcore that he didn't care. Steele wondered if it could be Stalker on his tail. He hoped it was. He was anxious to get the inevitable confrontation over with. His address was certainly no secret, thanks largely to the media. And Stalker could easily have found out where he lived. That had been one of his chief concerns right from the beginning. However, his building was well guarded by crack federal personnel and equipped with sophisticated automated defense systems. Jason and Raven were as safe there as they would be anywhere, which was why he had left strict orders that they not be allowed to leave under any circumstances. So long as Stalker was on the loose, they were in danger. What worried him most was Stalker's recent inactivity. He had broken out of the project labs like gangbusters, taken on a strike force squad in order to get their weapons, gathered a band of bloodthirsty tunnel dwellers, and wiped out most of the Green Dragons in a raid to seize their ordnance, and then nothing. He had simply disappeared from sight. Why? He had to be planning something. Only what? Steele knew that Higgins had been badgering Hardesty to send units down into the tunnels in an effort to flush Stalker out, but Hardesty, wisely, had resisted. For Higgins, the priority was simple. Find Stalker and neutralize him. Save the project. For Hardesty, the issue was a great deal more complex. He not only had to worry about finding and neutralizing Stalker, he had to worry about the safety of the city's populace as well. He did not want to risk taking units off patrol and sending them down into the tunnels, where they would be unable to respond quickly if Stalker and his derelict army struck in the streets above. Higgins might have pressed the issue harder, bringing federal authority to bear, but he was hesitant to do so with the media in full roar. Higgins realized that if Stalker struck and citizens of Midtown died, Hardesty could claim that there hadn't been a quick enough response because Higgins had ordered him to send his units down into the tunnels, and the media would then place responsibility squarely on his shoulders. The media had once been behind the project all the way, especially with Linda Tellerman doing the cheerleading. After Steele's part in the seizure of the Borodini enclave, she had undertaken that role, though not out of a belief in Steele and what the project had accomplished, but because her bottom line was ratings. With Steele regarded as a hero, she had quickly hitched her wagon to his rapidly ascending star. With Stalker, she had changed her tune. Now she was saying that the government was being irresponsible, endangering the people, pushing the new technology too fast and not observing proper safeguards, with the result that a killer cyborg had been unleashed upon a helpless city. And she saw no inconsistency in the change of her position. In her nightly reports, she was careful not to lump Steele in with Stalker as a menace to the city. Instead, she cast him in the role of victim, a pawn of an uncaring government bureaucracy that was now using him to make up for its mistakes. Steele and the police were still the heroes. The government and its irresponsible, uncaring technocrats were villains. And the only ones who won in such a situation were Linda Tellerman and the other media hounds who had taken up her battle cry. Personally, Steele cared nothing for the project. The last thing he wanted to see were more men transformed into cyborgs like himself. He did not wish that on anyone, least of all the man who'd been his partner and best friend. Still, he had his duty to perform, no matter how he felt about it, and the media weren't making things any easier. But there was no avoiding it. It would have been far worse if he had done as Higgins wanted and tried to keep the lid clamped down. The task would have been impossible. They would have found out anyway, and keeping them out of the loop would have only served to fuel their fire. And no matter how the end result turned out, Steele knew that he could only lose. Stalker was planning something. And whatever it was, Steele had to find him before he could carry it out. However, before he could do that, there was the matter of the tail he had picked up. Steele turned a corner and danced into the shadows of a storefront entrance. He did not have long to wait. In a few moments, the man came around the corner. But he was being cautious. The instant that he realized he had lost sight of Steele, he stopped, hesitating. Steele could hear his breathing. He could hear the increase in his heartbeat. The man suddenly realized he had been spotted. Steele quickly stepped out from concealment and leveled his battle rifle at him. "Move and you're dead!" "Don't shoot!" the man said. He was carrying a small two-way radio in his hand. He had it raised up halfway to his face and had frozen in the act, afraid to move so much as a muscle. "Go ahead," Steele said. "Make your call." The man swallowed hard, not taking his eyes off Steele for a second. He raised the radio up to his mouth and pressed the push-to-talk button. "Come in, Gino."
"Yeah, Shelley, go ahead."
He hung a left on 57th, heading east. Over.
"Got it. I'm right behind you. Stay loose. Don't let him spot you. Over."
Right, said Shelley, his gaze riveted to Steele's. Steele approached him with his hand out. Moving very slowly, Shelley handed him the radio. "How far back is he?" asked Steele. Four blocks, Shelley said. "On foot?" "No, in a car." "Who are you working for?" The man hesitated. "You've got about 3 seconds, Steele said. "Then I'll kill you and ask your friend."
"Victor Borodini."
Steele's heart gave a leap. "God damn," he said. "It must be Christmas." He stepped up to Shelley and quickly patted him down, relieving him of a 9mm, a 380, an 8-inch stiletto, and 2 fragmentation grenades. "Were these supposed to be for me?" Steele said, attaching the grenades to his belt. He tucked the 9mm into his waistband at the small of his back and slipped the smaller 380 into his pocket. Shelley wisely chose not to reply. "Sit down over there," said Steele, indicating a spot on the curb. Apprehensively, Shelley did as he was told. Steele took a hold of an old, rusted parking meter that was stuck up out of the sidewalk at a crazy angle. He grabbed it with both hands, clamped down hard, and pulled. Shelley watched with disbelief as the meter came loose from the sidewalk, along with a hefty chunk of concrete. Steele bent down and wrapped the parking meter around him, trapping his arms. Shelley cried out with pain.
"God, Jesus! My arms! You're crushing them!" "I'll crush a lot more than that if you don't shut the hell up," said Steele. "Now don't go away."
He left Shelley sitting on the curb with the meter wrapped around him and stepped back into the shadows. A moment later, a battered old Ford came cruising slowly around the corner. Gino spotted Shelley sitting on the curb and stopped the car.
"Yo, Shelley! What the fuck?"
He opened the door and stepped out.
"Jesus fucking Christ," he said. "You let him spot you, didn't you? You dumb shit! You're lucky he didn't..."
Steele stepped out of the shadows.
"Hold it right there, Gino! Holy shit!"
Gino called for his shoulder holster and pulled out a .38 revolver. Steele raised his 4.3mm barrel rifle with triple mode select fire and 50-round capacity and said,
"You've got to be kidding."
With an air of resignation, Gino dropped his gun.
"Open the back door," said Steele.
Gino complied.
"Now help your buddy in there," Steele said.
Gino helped Shelley to his feet. Stumbling under the weight of the parking meter with the attached lump of concrete, they made for the back door.
This thing ain't gonna fit through," said Gino.
"Open the trunk," said Steele.
"Oh, Christ, no, not the trunk," moaned Shelley.
"Would you rather I just left you here?" said Steele.
"No, that's okay,"
Shelley replied quickly. "The trunk will be just fine." Gino opened the trunk. Steele picked up Shelly as if he were a baby and dumped him in, meter and all. Shelly grunted with pain, and the car rocked on its beat-up shocks, and Steele closed the trunk lid. Steele went around to the passenger side and opened the door.
Get in, Gino. You're gonna drive.
Where to?
Where do you think, asshole? You're gonna get my daughter.
The ringing phone woke Raven up. She sleepily reached across for Steele, but his side of the bed was empty. She sat up groggily and took a deep breath, rubbing her eyes. Steele hadn't been to bed. He must have gone out. Maybe Stalker had been sighted once again. The phone kept ringing. As she swung her legs over the side of the bed, she heard Jason answer it. She started to go out just as she was, but then thought better of it and threw on a short silk robe. As she came out of the bedroom, she saw Jason standing with the phone up to his ear. His face was chalk white, and he was trembling.
What is it?
She said.
It's Stalker, Jason said. And he's got Corey!
Raven's eyes grew wide. She lunged for the speakerphone and switched it on.
Who the hell is this?
She demanded.
Bordini, if that's you, and...
Bordini's dead,
said the coarse and hollow-sounding voice on the other end of the phone.
And I've got the girl. Where's Steele?
Raven felt her stomach knot up.
He's not here. I don't know where he is. Is Corey all right?
She's fine. And if her daddy wants to come and see her alive again, he'll tell him to come to me. Alone. We'll settle this just between the two of us. You tell Steele. Nobody else. Cut out the trace that was on your line. If you call anyone else, I'll know. The girl will die. If Steele doesn't come alone, the girl will die. You tell him to go to Penn Station. Use the entrance off 7th Avenue. I'll be waiting for him.
The line went dead.
Oh, my God,
said Raven.
We've got to call Mr. Higgins,
Jason said.
No,
said Raven.
Stalker said that if we called anyone else, he'd know and he'd kill Corey. He stepped into the phone somehow.
Jesus, so what do we do?
Asked Jason, an agonized expression on his face. Raven bit her lower lip and thought fast.
Run downstairs and get ice. Quickly.
Jason didn't even bother to dress. He bolted for the door in his bare feet, still wearing his father's bathrobe. Raven ran back to the bedroom and started getting dressed. By the time Jason got back with ice, she was already dressed in jeans, boots, a sweatshirt, and a leather jacket over a bulletproof vest. She had taken one of Steele's weapons harnesses and adjusted it to fit her. Then she holstered two Beretta 9mm and slipped several extra loaded magazines into the pouches. She was sticking several hand grenades into her pockets when the door opened and Jason came back in with ice. Though Jason had awakened him, the big man had dressed as quickly as soon as he had heard what had happened.
What the hell you think you're doing, girl?
He asked when he saw her.
We've got to get Higgins,
she said.
He's the only one who can reach Steele. They've got some kind of broadcast link set up to reach him at the project lab.
What's all the hardware for?
Asked Ice.
You think I'm going to let Steele go in and face Stalker all alone, do you? And I don't want any arguments, Ice. I've been going crazy just sitting here, not knowing what the hell was going on. I'm going, and that's final.
She grabbed a machine pistol out of the arms cabinet, slapped in a 50-round magazine of caseless ammo, and grabbed some spares.
You crazy girl,
Ice said. I'm going to get dressed, said Jason. I'm coming with you.
Jason, no, you're staying here.
Forget about it, Jason said. She's my sister, goddammit, and I know how to shoot a gun. Dad taught me. I'm a good shot.
Hey, boy, this ain't no target range we're talking about,
said Ice.
You're gonna have to knock me out to stop me,
Jason said with grim determination. I know you could, but when I came to, I'd only follow you. I heard what Stalker said. I know where he's holding Corey. What would you do if it was your sister? Ice took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Still gonna have my ass for this. All right, go throw some clothes on.
Jason rushed back into his room.
You can't be serious,
said Raven.
You're not really going to let him come.
What do you want me to do, knock him on his ass?
Said Ice, walking over to the arms cabinet and taking out a polymer ceramic battle rifle.
Yes, if you have to,
she said.
For God's sake, Ice, you'll only get him killed.
Shit, girl, we're probably all going to get killed. But I ain't much better at sitting on my hands than you. I ain't going to ask the kid to do it. This be personal for him.
Oh, Christ, don't hand me that macho shit. He's just a boy.
He'd be man enough. If we going, you got a right to come.
Steele will never forgive you if anything happens to him.
Yeah?
Said Ice.
Or you either. Want I should knock you out too?
She realized that further argument was useless.
At least make him wear a vest.
Ain't gonna stop no plasma,
I said.
But at least it's something,
she said. She went out on the balcony and looked toward the helipad.
Steel's chopper is still here. We can take it to the federal building. I'll go wake the pilot.
She ran out to the small guardhouse at the far end of the helipad. Moments later, Jason was dressed and armed with a 9mm semi-auto, several grenades, and a battle rifle. Ice checked the fit on his vest.
You sure you know how to use them things?
He asked. I've never used grenades before, said Jason. But you just pull the pin and throw, right?
Yeah, right,
said Ice, shaking his head.
Come on.
They went out to the helipad. Raven was already standing by with the pilot, who had his VCASS helmet under his arm. Wait a minute, he said. What's going on here? Where's Steel?
He ain't coming on this trip,
said Ice.
You're gonna fly us over to the federal building.
The hell I will, the pilot said. I've got orders to stand by with this chopper for Lieutenant Steel. I'm not running any taxi service.
Listen to me,
Raven said.
Stalker's got Steel's daughter, and he's threatening to kill her. Steel ain't here. We don't know where he is. We've got to get over to the federal building and let Higgins know, so he can get in touch with Steel on the broadcast link.
Hell, why didn't you say so? Said the pilot. He hopped into the chopper and pulled on his helmet. A couple of the roof guards came hurrying over. What's going on here? One of them asked.
We're taking the chopper over to the federal building,
Raven said. I'm afraid I can't let you do that, ma'am, the guard said. We got strict orders from Lieutenant Steel not to let you folks leave the building.
You don't understand,
she said.
Stalker just called here. He's got Steel's daughter. We've got to get over to the federal building and see Higgins so he can let Steel know.
You could call him from here, ma'am.
I can't call him. Stalker's got the phone line tapped. He said he'd kill Corey if we called anyone. Steel's got to know.
You don't need all that ordnance just to deliver a message, said the guard. The pilot can fly over to the federal building by himself and just give Higgins the word. I don't know what you folks think you're doing, but you might as well forget it. We've got our orders. I'm sorry, but you're not going anywhere.
These orders apply to me too, Tony?
Said Ice, stepping up to the guard. No, we've got no orders about you, Ice. You can go, but Miss Scarpetti and the boy stay here. Ice turned back to Raven and Jason.
Afraid we got no choice,
he said.
You see how it is. You just gotta have to.
And then he suddenly drove his elbow back hard into the guard's solar plexus. The other two guards reacted immediately, bringing up their weapons. Ice managed to snatch the gun away from one of them, but the other one backed off and quickly worked the bolt on his rifle. Hold it right there, Ice!
What you gonna do, Scott?
Said Ice.
Shoot me?
The chopper's engine started and the blades began to turn. The man grimaced and lowered his weapons. Damn it, Ice!
Go on,
said Ice to Raven and Jason.
Get aboard.
If I let you go, they're gonna have my ass for it, said Scott.
Okay, I'm gonna make it easy on you,
Ice said.
When you wake up, tell Tony I was sorry I had to hit him.
And he crashed a hard right into Scott's jaw. The guard crumpled. Ice turned to the last guard.
Joey?
Oh, what the hell, said Joey. Go ahead. Ice dropped him with one punch. Then he got into the chopper and it lifted off. Higgins stood behind Jennifer Stone as she sat at the computer console in his office, staring with astonishment at the screen. Strings of alphanumerical representations of data were flying by so fast that they were nothing but a blur. I'm getting no response whatsoever, she said, shaking her head. There's nothing I can do to stop it. They had already tried shutting the computer down, but it would not shut down. Jennifer had tried working with the backup program when suddenly everything seemed to go haywire. The computer suddenly refused to respond to her keyboard commands. It was as if something had taken it over. Then they realized that someone was accessing the computer through the modem. They had pulled the plug. And still the computer kept working, flashing data across the screen at a dizzying rate. I don't believe it, Higgins said, staring at the screen with complete incomprehension. How the hell can it keep up working with the plug pulled? Where's the damn power coming from? He ran over to the intercom on the desk. Connors, he shouted. I want that goddamn trace. Now.
We're working on it, sir.
The security chief's reply came over the speaker.
Should have it for you any time now.
I don't want it any time. I want it now. God damn it. Someone's accessing top secret project data through a restricted line. I want to know who it is, what the fuck, and how the fuck they're doing it. The phone line, Jennifer said. hear her eyes wide as she looked up from the screen. What? The phone line! It's the only possible explanation. They're getting power from the computer through the phone line. That's impossible. How the hell can they do that? I don't know, but I can't think of any other explanation. Damn it, Higgins said. If I yank the line to the modem, we'll lose the fucking trace.
We've got it, Chief.
Connor's voice came over the intercom.
Hang on a second. We'll have the name and address up in a second. What the hell?
What? What is it? Higgins said.
You're not going to believe this, Chief. We traced the call back to Dev Cooper's apartment.
Cooper? Higgins said. He frowned. Are you absolutely sure?
No question, Chief. I'm sending a squad of men right away to find out what the hell's going on over there.
Dev Cooper's doing this? Asked Jennifer. I can't believe it. He wouldn't have the skill to pull off something like this, unless he's been hiding it all along. The Matrix! Higgins said, realization suddenly dawning. Jesus Christ. It has to be. It's Cooper's copy of the program. He rushed over to the computer and ripped out the modem. The screen winked out. Immediately, one of the screens in the wall console came on, flashing the same dizzying blur of data. Then another screen came on, and another one, and another one. What the fuck is happening? Said Higgins. It's transferred to the wall console through the power lines, said Jennifer with fascination. They're interfacing. Cooper's copy of the Matrix and ours are interfacing. Higgins bent down over his intercom again. Connors, when your people get to Cooper's place, have them shut down his computer immediately. Do you understand? Pull the plug. Smash the motherfucking thing to pieces if you have to, but shut it down. No, said Jennifer, coming up behind him. You can't. The hell I can't. I'm cutting this off until I can find out what the hell is going on. If you cut it off now, we might never find out, she said. Something absolutely amazing is happening here, Oliver. Let it go. Let's see what happens. No way, said Higgins with grim determination. I've learned my lesson with Stalker. I'm not taking any chances. I'm stopping it right now until we get some kind of handle on this. He turned back to the intercom. Connors, the minute your people get over there, I want an immediate report. I want to know what's going on over there. I want... Jennifer suddenly grabbed his arm. Oliver! The tone of her voice made him turn around immediately. He froze when he saw what was on the screens. The center screen of the wall console had ceased its blurring images of data and now showed something else entirely. One by one, the other screens stopped flashing data and switched to the same images as the one in the central screen until all of them were displaying the same thing. A videotape of Higgins and Jennifer making love on the office desk. Oh my God, said Higgins softly. Jennifer was staring at the screens, speechless. Higgins glanced up at the surveillance camera mounted on the ceiling in his office. You made a tape of this? She said, Jennifer, turning to him with shocked disbelief. No, of course not, Higgins said, still staring at the camera. That camera was off. I only have it switched on when I leave the office. The goddamn Matrix must have switched it on somehow. The bastard made a tape of us. Is anyone else seeing this? She asked in a shocked voice, her gaze riveted to the images of herself and Higgins coupling passionately on the desk. No, said Higgins. At least, I don't think so. How could they? Unless. He spun around and hit the button on the intercom. Connors!
They should be getting there any minute now, Chief.
Never mind that. I want all the power to the US office shut down now. Right now, right this instant. There was a brief silence. Connors, do you hear me?
I'm not sure how to do that, sir. I'll have to get the building engineers.
Do it! Whatever it takes, do it. But do it now. I want all the power in here off.
Oliver, she said, clutching his arm. I'm scared.
Take it easy, he said. We're going to get this under control. But he didn't sound so sure. Then suddenly, one by one, the screens winked off. But the office lights stayed on. The power hadn't been cut off yet. What happened? Higgins said. Jennifer slowly shook her head.
I don't know.
They stood there and stared at the dark screens for what seemed like a long time, and then suddenly the lights in the office went out. They've cut the power, Higgins said. He took Jennifer by the arm. Come on. They left the office and hurried down the hall to the office of the chief of project security. What's going on? Asked Higgins as they went in. Connors was seated at his desk wearing a headset. The power off? He asked. Yeah, it just went off. What's happening? Connor held up a finger. He was listening. They just got back to Cooper's place, he said. They had to break in. Cooper's passed out on his couch, dead drunk. What about his computer? Jennifer asked. Connors relayed the question into the tiny headset mic. It was on when they came in, he said. But they say there's nothing on the screen. It's blank. There's nothing booted up. That can't be, said Higgins. There's got to be software on the drives. Have them check it out. Connors passed the order on. They waited tensely. Connors looked back up at them. They say it's blank, he said. What do you mean it's blank, said Higgins. Erased, Connors replied. Wiped clean. Cooper's out like a light, and there was no one else in the apartment. Higgins frowned. It doesn't make any sense. What do you want me to do about Cooper? Connors asked. Have him brought here. I don't care if they have to carry him, but I want him back here on the double. Connor relayed the order. A buzzer went off, and a light on his desk console came on. He stabbed a button. Connors, he said. This had better be important. We've got a situation here. They could hear the caller through the console speaker.
It's Sergeant Flattery, sir, down at the lab. There's something funny going on down here. Some of the workers finishing up here said a bunch of the databanks came on, all of a sudden, by themselves. I swear they haven't touched anything, but somebody must have tripped a switch or something. I don't know. I tried calling Dr. Stone at her office. There's no answer.
Jennifer turned and bolted from the office. Stand by, Flattery. She's on her way down, said Connors. He looked up at Higgins. What the hell's going on? But Higgins was already running out the door. Corey was more frightened and confused than ever. They had taken the freight elevator down to the basement level, and just before the doors opened, Stalker had shoved her into a corner at the front of the elevator, telling her to crouch down and to not move. He inserted fresh magazines to his AK-47s and stood in front of the door, holding one in each hand by the wood pistol grips. The door slid open, but nothing happened. Stalker turned to Corey and told her to follow him. She got up quickly and went out into the basement, and froze, her eyes and mouth opened wide in horror. The walls of the basement were pockmarked with bullet holes. The floor was littered with bodies and sticky with blood. The large, heavy steel reinforced door to the passageway leading to the subway tunnel had been smashed in and lay on the floor. The two legs were sticking out from underneath it.
Come on,
said Stalker.
Hurry up.
As he spoke, she heard the sound of footsteps running down the stairs. Stalker grabbed her roughly by the arm and shoved her toward the passageway. As he turned, several Borodini soldiers came running down the stairs and into the basement. They opened up on him with assault rifles and Viper machine pistols. Corey stared with shocked disbelief as the bullet slammed into his chest. He staggered backwards from the impact, but didn't fall. Ragged holes appeared in his jumpsuit. One bullet tore off a piece of his right ear. Another creased his scalp. His head snapped back sharply as another struck him in the forehead, just above his left eye, and ricocheted off his nice steel skull casing. But he didn't even seem to feel it. He opened up with both assault rifles, sweeping the stairs leading down into the basement. Men screamed and their bodies tumbled down to the foot of the stairs, piling up into bloody, bullet-shredded heaps. Stalker turned, blood streaming from his ear, but there was no blood coming from the wounds in his scalp and forehead, no blood coming from the bullet holes in his chest and upper thighs. The polymer skin on his scalp and forehead was torn from the impact of the bullets, and gleaming knife steel showed through. His eyes were glowing red fire. Corey cried out and shrank from him in fear. He threw down one of the empty rifles and grabbed her by the hand, pulling her down the passageway after him. She had to run to keep up. Several times she stumbled, but he didn't stop. He just kept pulling her on. They reached the end of the passageway and came out into a dark subway tunnel. There were no lights in the tunnel, but Stalker's eyes suddenly flared with a bright, white-yellow light, and twin beams shot out from his eyes, illuminating the tunnel in front of them. He pushed her ahead of him.
Come on,
he said.
Move, quickly.
Dazed, she went in front of him, her form silhouetted in bright beams coming from his eyes. Her mind was numb with overload. They moved through the tunnels for what seemed like an impossibly long time, turning from one tunnel to another, until she had lost all sense of where they were, what direction they were heading in. She wept and cried out in revulsion, as rats skittered across her feet. They moved down the dank, musty tunnels, and she kept tripping on the tracks, stumbling over piles of refuse that smelled terrible. She did not look down. She was afraid to see what they were. They came upon a hideously decomposing body of some tunnel dweller, or perhaps one of their victims, slumped against the tunnel wall, the flesh shriveled with the bones showing through, the teeth horribly exposed in a death rictus. Rats crawled over the corpse, maggots writhed in what was left of the torso. Corey started screaming. She couldn't stop. Her screams echoed through the tunnel like the whistle of a train. Stalker pulled her on her arm, and she was yanked off balance. She fell against him, but she still couldn't stop screaming. Then it became all too much for her conscious mind to bear. Her eyes rolled up and she fainted. Effortlessly, Stalker lifted her up and slung her over his shoulder. He turned off his illuminating beams. He didn't need them now. He could see perfectly in the dark, and he didn't need to worry about the girl tripping over things she couldn't see. He continued walking through the tunnels. Soon he could see the light of a campfire in the distance. They were close to Pennsylvania Station. He left the unconscious girl with the tunnel dwellers, giving them strict orders not to touch her. A few of them stared at her with either sexual or physical hunger. Perhaps both. But he didn't need to worry about their disobedience. He told them that if he returned and found her harmed in any way, he would kill all of them. He went to make the call to Steel. When Jason answered on the phone, a flicker of recognition passed through him at the sound of the boy's voice, but he forced it away. He didn't want to be distracted. It was becoming increasingly difficult for him to concentrate. He was experiencing violent mood swings. One moment, he could feel elated, as he had been when they had hit the dragons. That, he felt, had been a good thing, though he wasn't certain why. But it had made him feel good. For a while, the fever in his cybernetic brain abated, but after he had tapped into the line and made the call, he was once more plunged deep into black depression. He remained monitoring the phone network for a while, his brain keyed to remain alert for any call emanating from Steele's number. But meanwhile, he simply scanned the network, listening into different conversations, different slices of the human condition unfolding in the city above him. One man was calling home to his family, telling his wife that he would be forced to work late at the office. He'd be late for dinner. His wife sounded disappointed. The children were back with their grandparents, and she had prepared a special meal for him, the same thing they'd had when they first met. It was their 10th anniversary, and she had planned a special evening for them.
"I've even put on the same dress I was wearing when we had our first date," she said.
"Really? You mean that slinky blue one?"
"Yes, I got it out of storage. Would you believe that it still fits me?"
"Yeah, I'd believe it,"
he said.
"I've got the table all set, and I've got the candles out."
"Oh, honey.
Well, that's okay. Dinner will keep, I guess."
She sighed with resignation.
"Will you be very late?"
"I'll try to wind up things here as quickly as I can, I promise."
"You do what you have to do,"
she said.
"I'll wait."
"I love you."
"I love you too."
He monitored another call.
"I've been thinking about you all day." "Were you really?" "I can't seem to get you out of my mind."
"I've been thinking about you too."
"When can I see you again?"
"Tomorrow night."
"How about dinner? I know a nice Italian place over on 86th. Great food, dim lights, soft music."
"You like Italian food?"
"I love it. Why don't you?"
"Are you kidding? I'm half Italian. I've got a better idea. Why don't I make dinner for you?"
"You're kidding. You can cook too?"
"I make a lasagna you would die for. And we could dim the lights and put on some music."
"Sounds very romantic. What time do you want me there?"
7-ish? That'll give me time to take a bath and put on something comfortable."
"You want your back scrubbed?"
"No, I think I can manage. Besides, if we start with that, we might never get to dinner. And I want to show off my cooking."
"I'll be at there at 7 on the dot."
"Okay then. Oh, and one more thing."
"What's that?"
"Bring your toothbrush."
He scanned the network and listened in on idle bits of conversation. Starker grew more and more depressed. These people had lives. They lived, they loved, they fought, they struggled, they survived. What did he have? He had nothing. Nothing but fleeting glimpses of past lives that were his, and yet not his. Nothing but a maelstrom of emotions that pulled him in different directions at once. Nothing but self-loathing for what he was and a surging hatred for those who'd made him that way. He recalled hearing the voice of Dr. Philip Gates as he was brought online, a voice filled with pride and excitement.
"He should be waking up any second now.
God, I'm just nervous as a schoolboy getting ready for your first day.
Doctor's going to be bowling them over. My greatest achievement. When they see what he can do, they'll be falling all over themselves to fun Roger Dale."
And then the voice faded away and he heard another one. The voice of a small girl laughing as he bounced her on his knee. The twin boys laughing too and shouted, "Me next, Daddy, me next!" And he saw his wife beaming at them as they played in the living room. But he didn't know the woman. He had no idea who the children were. Voices. Memories with nothing to be rooted in. A cornucopia of confusing and conflicting images whirling through his mind like a howling hurricane. He disengaged from the network and grabbed his head, doubling over and groaning. He smashed his fist into the wall again and again and again, And yet again, but it didn't help. There was no pain to drive away the fever in his computer brain. The wall merely crumpled to dust and fragments of broken concrete. He screamed with rage, agony, and frustration, and the sound echoed throughout the darkness. He tried with every ounce of his will. He had to focus in on just one thing. Steel. It was Steel who was responsible. It was because of Steel that they did this to him. It was the Steel Project that had brought him all this torment, and it was Steel who would pay. Slowly, the jumble of confusing images and voices faded to be replaced by a grim purpose. The resolution of a mission that had to be accomplished. The programmed imperative taking over. The mission accomplished the mission. Let nothing interfere. Destroy the enemy. That enemy was Steel. End of chapter.